Welcome to the Seamusini Centre podcast. I'm Rachel Brown. In this episode, we hear some of the new poems made during our annual poetry summer school, which is led by Nick Laird, who we'll hear from later on. The summer school ran online for the first time this year, and so instead of reading their work together live to an audience in Belfast, participants in this year's summer school have each recorded a poem or two in their own homes for this virtual summer school showcase. First, we're in London with Genevieve Stevens, and then Minneapolis for two poems by Stephen Blythe.
Hem. How long has it been like this? For a moment, I didn't know if she meant the skirt or my life. But as she then cleared space to lay flat the hem, her hands existing only for that bit of fallen fold, well, I put the answer away. We grew silent. Me appalled by the everything almost said out loud, or perhaps it's all been heard in other rooms, older houses. And the longer I sat watching her, the more I became grateful for the hem, for its sudden, simple undoing, for her, always knowing which stitch is best. Grateful too for that pristine exchange, my need, her capacity. Sometimes a bird says bird, and it is good to travel no further. To hear only it and not all birds in all gardens, or God forbid, to muse on seasons or song, because nothing is as obvious and remarkable as the bird in the hawthorn. And so here I am. Next to me, the curtains fill and lift on the draught. The chair is in the corner. My light is still on.
Visitation. I reached into my green winter coat pocket and found it. It was a drawing full of stick figures in various sizes, a child's drawing. I want to tell you how I began to cry and laugh uncontrollably when I saw it. Another slip of awkward origami, the penciled signature of an oblong heart. My daughter, you are all about hidden in the random, you with your pieces of paper torn from yellow memo pad, tucked away beneath the pens and clips, or otherwise placed in the psyche. Today there are no more notes, but I dream I am finding them magnetic on the refrigerator or stuffed in some shoes I never wear. A strand of spiral ink held my hand and one I pulled from the coffee. And there is this one where you have made many question marks surround the idea of me. The monitor. Let's build a ship and then add a large turret, I said. You giggled and shook me, then I shook you. We laughed. It made our screens jiggle. You said my face was wobbly on your tablet, all my fatherly features turned bright babble of pixel. Let's build a ship and then add the large turret, I said. Boxes upon boxes of gray plastic models. I had them sent to you so we could pretend. Boxes upon boxes of the gray plastic models. I had them sent so I could feel myself inside of your room. Let's build a ship and then add our little men, our little crew. So you propped me square against the edge of your bed and turned away to construct our vessel. I studied you this way, tidy in my monitor, for days. Let's add the large turret and then see how far it will fire. The yellow foam bullets you shot me with were soft against my cheek. The yellow foam bullets, I still feel them through the radiant circles on my screen. Let's add an anchor and then we'll have all that we need. But you didn't hear me this time, so I stared at your ceiling. I watched you rummage through the pieces, knowing the pieces would thin as your ship neared completion. That's the fan I installed last year, I said. I touched my face today, tried to feel our imaginary wounds.
Hello, my name is Elena Offield, and this is a poem of mine called Puake Summer. It felt like waiting for condensation to run. The air toffee thick, wanting wind,
sweating, peeling apart shirt skins from my back. I show you my goosebumps and you touch, calling the heat prickly, the sunset's cotton candy. I memorize your bent back, scraped knees. You always had a project, extracting the guts of a toy, a microwave, making the most of things washed up on our desert shores, trash treasures Frankensteined together. Things were always breaking down around here. We ride our bikes all over town, using pocket money to buy paletas, waiting for the moon to arrive. Casino billboards invite anyone to stop here. We go howling through the arroyo, our voices over and into the hot wind, blowing across our freeway quilted desert. Cars pass the billboards, but don't turn back. We peek in the plastic-wrapped windows of new houses built for people not from here. People bold enough to trade traffic and Starbucks for monsoon rains and quaking aspens. They concrete the ditches that line their land, and when the rains bring soft, vulnerable water, it flows straight forever, unable to cut its own path. Money can rewrite nature, bulldoze the past. Money is the balloon that brought a man to Oz and named him a wizard. We wait, watching roadrunners building a second sun for our joy, divining our adulthood from the purple sky. Let the wind blow golden over the broken things, the unfinished projects. At the bus stop. Her laugh begins with her teeth and stops in the split ends of her hair. She looks out of place, fizzing and forming a right angle. Her back is an anchor. Her palms are upturned and they meet, like praying, but the kind I want to know. Her open mouth is a pulsing cave. Only her eyes tell me she isn't in pain. She holds her laugh out to the bus driver. Preciously, he accepts it as payment. I want to ask her what it feels like. I covet her smile and laugh and easiness. I haven't been this close to joy. She exists in ways that I miss. If she is combustible, then I am a matchbook. She creates a storm, and I am not afraid, because I have made storms too. And I imagine you living outward on the same sidewalks as this woman, making brief eye contact with a cashier as you pay for a coffee, a scone. I imagine you leaving fingerprints on bus seats and tabletops, sticking your gum to the bottom of a chair. You come home, and I'm trying to reach you from across my invisible universe to the land of the living. You exist in ways that I miss.
Hi, my name's Kevin O'Farrell. I'm a poet from Dublin, and I'm going to read two poems today. The first one is Wittgenstein at the Great Palm House, Glasnevin. In a rusting wrought iron skeleton, clad in clouded panes of glass, warmth stays hidden in plain sight from this barren land of winter. Now nursing rows of eager hands, now impertinent penises, as the professor, on his usual step, idly dissects Goethe's earth plants, to find not organic or platonic form, but a common connective impulse. Succumbing to his old Sehnsucht, he could be in the Palmen House again. The steam keeps rising towards the windows and weeps to find its limitations. And the second poem I'd like to read is called Jungler. That lag could take off anyone, anytime or anywhere, and each insult he tossed landed like a last gasp Hail Mary. His lips would juggle between contraries, struggling to contain a laugh at those who'd call this smuggling, which must be such a pain in the arse on more than one level. Come the next day's breakfast, he'd be off again, living pillar to post, like a devil chased by the angelic host, having plucked with his mandolin heavenly notes, the sweeter for being stolen. And for a long time after, girls blew hard on dandelions that somersaulted over the fields, pursued by mother's rosaries.
Next we hear two poems by Grace Tower, followed by poems by Lorraine Carey.
Today, I am your favourite grandchild. I watch your sunburned feet in sandals stamped through blackened thistles in Pidyma, Greece. Then you reel off the Latin for plants whose purple flowers pause their shaking display when I repeat after you, syllabum marianum. The letters are like spikes in my mouth, but will soften with each say. Dropped from your worn OED, my nickname hits the ground and yo-yos back up again, angel baby number one. Here are the dynamics of bracken after fire, rows and columns scorched on the tongue, new shoots, words curl into fists. I've booked another night. Yes, this time there's a bath in the ensuite. Oakfield Psychiatric Unit. My friend, on his 21st birthday, graffitis the DVD covers slipped out their plastic cases. With a pen, he splits Scarlett Johansson's face into sections, pink lines like the body's crime tape. He used to leave me notes in the visitor's room, number plates of the cars outside, but now he just sits by the TV, holding up his shoes to the glow-in-the-dark plug on the wall to check they're not hiding knives. Do you know what day it is? I ask, as he filters through photos from prom I've brought. I wish, he replies. In his room, I find a plastic knife lying on a Scrabble board, its blunt blade pointing to a triple word score. Through the window, I watch a red car reverse into a birdbath and drive off without going back for it.
Visitor. On Thursday morning, I find an adult swallow belly down on the paving beside the garden shed. I knelt to pick it up. It weighed the same as the slice of buttered toast in my other hand. A half loll of its dusty head confirmed what I knew, the body still beautifully warm. I spread the lamp black tail, a perfect fork of silken plumage, familiar with the curve and sweep of Saharan sands, the meander of jet stream winds. Elegance isn't confined to those with beating hearts. Strings. My father arrived with gifts for me and my five-day-old son. Drunk, tired, unsteady on my feet, I was pale and grey as an overcast morning. The others hid the shell shock well. My body felt bombed on the ward where restorative sleep ghosted me. He passed across a book of poems wrapped in brown paper and string. He held me there and smoothed my unruly frizz, like the time I was seven and flew off my bike, broken and mangled with a teeming lip. I handed his grandson over. His limbs squirmed from the cellular blanket, riddled with holes. I kept it all in until he left and I read the penciled inscription. When you have time, love, Dad. Exchanges with Brent Geese. A coastline can pardon a metropolis in a roar of surf, in gritty sea salt layers, in an ocean mist sift of attrition. Water, the most cunning shapeshifter of all, distracts from the grey high rises and in the gush break barrel of waves. Survival's easier along a coast if you really listen. Thousands of miles from home, I imagined this city long ago, its Mohawk name Tekoronto, where trees stand in the water. I took some photos, noted rail tracks below and the mosaic from Ripley's Aquarium. Wondered were the Brent geese still there on the Kerry shore, bobbing waves for algae and eelgrass, counting down spring one day at a time, weathering much milder winters until departure, and in their flight path, Toronto, where trees once stood in the water.
Hello, this is Tim Dwyer, and I'm recording this in Bangor County Down, thanks to the Seamus Heaney Summer School staff and team members for helping me with these poems. The first poem, reading C.D. Wright, 1980. I'm back on the mud-brown sofa, one of the legs ready to give way, cases of Schmitz for end tables. Midwest living room, ever twilight, like the evening news on the black and white TV. The brittle fern by the back window, unwatered day after day. With each toke, I am more adrift with the next line of the next poem I wish was mine. A boy from another country crawls out of the moonlight of the attic. Closing your book, the room in a smoky haze. Again and again, I read a telegram of betrayal, an endless novena, while my writing disappears. And this next poem is entitled The Next Phase, Ballyhome Bay, June 2020. From the pebbled shore, we see white ferries pass each other. One approaching Belfast, another sails to the Irish Sea. A young boy in swimming togs points to them. Angel ships, he announces to his father standing near. Angel ships, his father echoes, arriving just in time.
Just over a year ago, I had a major operation on my spine, and both the poems I'm going to read come out of that experience. I realise that doesn't sound very cheerful, so I should add the operation was a success. Very quickly, very fast. This time he thinks he's got it right. He says he used to cook prawns too slow, but when he lifts the lid from the blue dish, they gleam pink and slightly curled. My friend smiles with the side of his face that still manages the flicker of a smile. He tells us to dive in and eat, and we do, though ginger and garlic's almost too much for me after the soup and white bread of hospital food. I gaze across the room at four framed drawings of a bearded man, black and white, propped against the wall. Since his surgery, my friend draws and cooks with the passion he used to have for things you couldn't eat or see. I ask which drawing he did first. He can't remember, but springs up from his chair to lift the one his teacher liked. He gestures to show how each charcoal drawing was made very quickly, very fast, with just four strokes. I'm slow, but I enjoy having the time to sit and study this charcoal man who leans forward, sits back, turns his head, and scratches a left ear, the same ear with which my friend no longer hears. Inevitably, after an operation like that, there are lots of appointments back at the hospital, which can get a bit tedious, but mine were made a bit more interesting because it was at Guy's, which is where Keats trained as a surgeon. And in between appointments, I was able to wander into the science gallery, which is nearby. Body parts. Of his bones are coral made. I've seen deep inside myself, in scans that trace each bone along my spine, yet fail to show a body I recognise as mine. I need to leave the hospital with its symptoms and tests and take a walk to anywhere. That's how I come to be in the science gallery with a woman who demonstrates 3D printing of body parts and asks me to choose between a skull, a brain, a heart. I choose an ear. The memory cards inserted, hot pink or electric blue, pink. I watch it silently unspool. The woman says this PLA, like me, will biodegrade. I think about this as layer on layer a base is laid, and with complex geometries a mouse-sized ear is made. She places its small perfection in my hand, and happy to amaze, leads me to a video of sea coral grafted as a substitute for bone. Full fathom 5 runs through my head. I carry the ear away, wrapped in a tissue, and retrace my steps to the hospital, past Keats's house in St. Thomas Street. He knew about symptoms and decay.
And that was Rebecca Farmer. Next, we're in Dublin and London as we hear from Sinead Nolan and then Ian Whiteley.
Grapefruit. I cut the halves into quarters and they fall away from the sharp edge of my knife. Presenting as an orange, I see now that this fruit is a grapefruit. Excited by the thought of eating it in the afternoon, I savour the quarantine that allows me this transgression. We have otherwise been controlled. Where the knife splits the fruit, it bleeds sticky over the wood. 4 segments line the chopping board, and on the radio they count the dead. I pick a piece and bend it towards me. Flesh springs from skin, sinews eager to respond to the truth of my teeth. Juice screams into my red open mouth. I finish the grapefruit greedily, stack the rinds beside the bin. I lick the chopping board clean. There is no need to fear death. Lie down in your garden at night and let the sky open and catch you. Take your shoes off in the forest. Feel the mud between your toes. Make ripples in seawater. You'll see yourself in the ocean. Feel your skin's pebbled shoreline, then stop in the rain and hear it speak. Understand your heartbeat is a brief rhythm and ending. Know that you are made of the mud that you will be buried in. Death is a covering of earth and a return to moss.
Staying out for pizza. Now I'm middle-aged, teetering on success, aware my happiest days are numbered. I find myself panicked by your twilight call from Hanoi, which pricks like those night times back when answering was chancing. You tell me your plans and I'm 13 again, ringing from a payphone. I am staying out for pizza. My shivers now must be the ones you felt then. I'm 80, you say. Exactly, I say. How will you cross the road? You chuckle like gravel. Tell me it's only Hanoi. Say it's good practice for when you're further away. Sublet. And in this world, my worktop an industrial lamp, feeling consequential, the belongings of a young couple, the son of a Polish success, the great-granddaughter of a Jewish maid, and here they are, come good with this elegant space in govern, and me, all Lady Macbeth, tarnishing the wood grain in the kitchen of the place they say I love for its retro furniture, him filtered and Instagram ready, not in that moment knowing me bunkered away from death, lies, asphyxiation, injustice, all my anger directed at the wine stain, rubbing till it's chafed, furious, blistered, a scuff-marked disaster of my own making, the difference being that I will admit to this, pay for it, offer contrition like herbal bitters, never deny in the face of all fact and truth, not like nasty bastards, blusters of privilege, cheating blondes, grotesque hypocrites, evidence twisters, public fictioneers, plinth-clutching shit-speakers, brazen liars, shameless, questions create questions, denial, move on, refusal, rebuke, silly boy. Well, I can be a narcissist too, you murderers. I can say yes, behold my legacy, here on this worktop, me.
I'm Rachel Donati. Today I'm reading two poems. The first I wrote on March the 19th this year, after watching London being quietly and a little stealthily being packed up and put away as we went into lockdown. Can we? Can we, do you think, just lie down together? Make carpet hotel floors soft, make faces for sun, not strip lights. Can we, do you think, have a sound conversation with our mouths? Make polyester, not plastic. Make a life with no exits. Make normal. Stop 30 minutes late. Stop rationing time. Stop air conditioning. Can we, do you think, walk small dust tracks where lights are never switched on? Naples neon, Vespa, kids football, teenage dreams are so long. Which way next? Why? Can we inside suite shutter together? What would the dogs do? London's emptying, but we are rabid. This next poem looks at AI, how we use it and treat it, and the idea of the body and sex in this new robotic age we now find ourselves in, and reflects upon our own idea of humanity. It's something that interests me. Why do we act this way? Demisexual, aromantic, scoliosexual, native digisexuals are sexting with hookup apps, deepfakes, fake app. The sex robots hang dangle on shoulder blades in hooks. They hold talk, joke tell, speak Shakespeare, do sex whenever asked, dear. The girl you have always dreamed about. 14 different styles of labia, 42 nipple options, 3 holes and sex programmed from 8,000 hours of pornography. Swappable face. Build her personality. Kind, innocent, intellectual, funny, jealous. Vision is the art of seeing. A hitchhiking robot was beheaded in Philly. A security robot was punched to the ground in Silicon Valley. A teaching robot was attacked with a baseball bat and pleaded for help. A sex robot was hard-fucked by 5 men to melt. I do know, and I've said it plenty of times, that you could, should find someone who fits you better, hurts you less.
My name is Julia Whiting, and I am honored to be joining the Poetry Summer School from Honolulu, Hawaii, the lovely valley of Palolo. So these are two poems that I wrote during the summer school when I was staying in a hotel in Waikiki in order to accommodate the time change. So they're a little bit wacky, but I am delighted to share them with you all. Bundle, bosom, folded in a garment. I write about math like I know math. You say you want me to write myself. I'll write about this math. I love it. Love the idea of the math, which is not the math itself. And pretend to tell you the thing you want, which is myself, which is divisible. Simple, a simple concept, division, until you get to identity statements, which were always a thing I loved, this long string of signs, trigonometric, etc., that were also zero, also one. So when you get to them, you slip them out, slip in the simple thing, the easy zero, one, and there's this reduction, a way out of hating trigonometry, which hates you too, by the way, a way of being totally about the process of getting to that thicket of hating each other, a process of sitting in a classroom and doing everything together, the doing some people get, only some people, and some people love, only some people, and everyone pretends it, math, matters, when division clearly matters, but trig is a poignant way of rationing that mostly circles around and around until you need to look yourself in the face in order to know your face is there. So that's why it's a swap, math and the idea of math. You want one circle. Here's this other one. Carry it. Across here, balance this basket on your head. Duck under the bar, the double bar. You solved it. Confusion. You have a term that presents like recognition, feels like a small fuck, a puzzle about what's in the basket you're carrying, where you think, it's a puzzle, when it was always more like proximity, like we're ready for fucking problems. Dividing a decimal into another decimal, the percent of my life that is worry, cut it into the percent remaining. Here, this language of particular tension, 0.66 repeating, my face, the lines, the entity you're after. Frozen margarita. It only takes me one to get bombed. Being 50 seems horrible and 70 delightful. I'm sure I've got it wrong. I imagine, though, the age you'd chuck it all to buy a red car, have sex outside, maybe those done things in other lives. I'm trying to read the funk into sonnets. I'm trying to account for fear. The negation of fear is a moving body, the one I want to have. The funk in sonnets, the way they lie on the shelf. Here's a pun. Mold, molding, pin it. He says, let's only say it once and say it right. Like a henge, just enough near distance for a mystery. He says, it's so heavily defended, this. The scar tissue so thick on top. When is the age of talking out loud? When does obviousness clear a path? Shitty questions you don't ask from a red car. Do you? Or when you're having sex outside? Hot. Outside, feverish. The shower trees shed flowers suggestively. Being ahistorical, now a worry of mine. Do something, fret a bit, sip. That rainbow of blossoms is utterly something.
And this is Tom Day with two poems. He'll be followed by Dee Dee.
The first poem I'm going to read is about the death of Tommy Cooper. It's entitled Last Act. It felt like the finale, the magic cloak skit bunglingly executed, given the ultimate twist, the audience killing themselves laughing, the master of mistiming surpasses himself. But it lingered on a shade too long, the gurn, the sitting up slump, the snoring, and something strangely rising from the cloak. Cut to the emergency ad break, then lights out, sleep sound. The morning after, I learned from Dad that Tommy had died live on stage, just like that. Houdini's dead, Horace Golden's dead, Dante's dead, all the great magicians are dead. I don't feel so good myself. And the second poem I want to read is called Voice Print, for Eric Griffiths. The master's dog? True, you had a bark, bitchily untangling the tumorous bitch. But your words, the poet, had an edge too dutiful to be pure burlesque, as if they were a species in themselves. Your lecture was electric, I wrote 2 days later, the stress is evident, the hieratic punctuated by a sprightly wit. What was that gag about closet drama? Was there one about the poet Monquet? Even to know that one has lost one's voice, you wrote, is an effect of voice. Your voice is missed.
This poem is not titled with words. Instead, it is titled with a mathematical symbol, the equals sign. The lines, like two adjacent tight ropes, brand their equals into skin, failing to match perfectly, as the hand must have wobbled with a view so great, since an abyss can always terrify. The knives had gleamed their devilish smile to trap soul kites in the underworld. The consequence, a prideful addition, while the subtraction of self-worth swelled up and down, like the frequency monitors in hospitals, where life and psyche teeter. The green moat. Round once and then again you go, circling the house like a red pen, marking out job ads and newspapers. He follows, our growing friend child, the veil bearer. His hair shortens as his height lengthens, and new clothes appear with each loop of the year. This is you playing grown up. This is me laughing, doing the same. We're becoming real. We are real people, with cars and houses and lawnmowers that bandage me in. Inside the house, I sit, my bruises wrapped like a Christmas present, smiling every time you hula hoop with the noisy grass eater. Our green cut moat is our wedding ring, halo and commitment to our lives, together like salt to a meal.
My name is Stephanie Green. This poem is from a series of poems inspired by mythological sea monsters on a map of Iceland by Ortelius in 1590. It's called The Rauida, and it's in the voice of an old man in a hospice. The letter H appears in the poem. This H stands for Hval, which is Icelandic for whale. The Rauida. A dark red H. I once knew the word. On the black funnels of whaling ships, I pray your flesh, dark red, will cure me. But I must have nil by mouth. Strung up, fed with liquids like the gulps of sea that swooshed through your baleen, a vast brush, each cold, rubbery strand jammed tight, trapping thousands of microorganisms as once every sensation, pulse of life, filtered through my brain. How many remembered now? Synapses fizzling, blackout. Acrid smoke fluctuates, revealing sunlit trees as I walk through a wood down to the beach, holding my mother's hand. Who is the stranger who seems to know me as she kisses my forehead? A young man comes less often and is impatient to be gone. He seems familiar. One of my shipmates, perhaps, who sniffs the kelp and salt on the wind and hears, as I do, the call of the white seas.
And finally, joining us from Canada, Erin Vance.
Bloodletting. Mary, I will care for your leeches, and I will not say that you possess me, I will not call you a wonder, or claim to be your beating heart. Mary, I will kiss your leeches, and when I am hurt, I will feed them with my blood. There are no demons in our bodies or our minds, but yes, yes, it feels as if there might as well be. This disease is a burning, a bruising, a breaking, a bleeding. Bleed with me, Mary. Bleed with me until the shaking stops and the wind settles and we are no longer leech dry by our own brains. Bleed with me, Mary. We are already so tired. Note. Mary Roth, 1846 to 1865, suffered from seizures from the age of 6 months to her death at 19 years old. Her untreated epilepsy and depression led to her death in an asylum where she was treated terribly. 14 years later, her story was immortalized by another young woman in her town who claimed that she was possessed by the deceased Mary Roth. Confession. After Elsie Wright and Francis Griffiths, photographers of the Cottingley Fairies. When Francis followed the little thing into the shallow beck, I stayed back watching her stockings sag in the water, flapping at her ankles like second skins. Francis batted her eyelashes and the imp trusted her. Confession. I wished to catch it and place it in a box like a pet in a spider silk dress, pull it out at parties to flutter and tease and spit. When Francis giggled as its wings tickled her rosebud cheek, I confess I wanted to hold its gossamer body in my palm, knowing that I could practically crush it with my breath. The waters of the beck leaked onto my shoe, the cold water like tiny elfin teeth biting my toes, a gasp and, oh, the thing is dead. Caught under Francis's fat palm, she slipped on a patch of moss. The photos may be fake, but the fairies, they were real, weren't they, Francis? Bone Dazzler, after Quinta Maggia MacDonald. She worked long, glowing hours, painting numbers, licking paint. She wasn't there to catch the reluctant pearls of her daughter's milk teeth as they fell out, but Quinta's teeth, that once clutched rags as she pushed that small body from hers, shook themselves loose from her mottled jaw, and moth-eaten she collected them from the factory floor and placed them into a small green bottle.
Oh, hi, it's Nick Laird here. I just wanted to quickly add a note about how pleased and proud I am of the work that you guys all did in the summer school this year. It was just a pleasure. And I think we had lots of good interactions and good readings of the poems, and the poems were generally of a really high standard, and everyone came to it with an open mind and was supportive, so that was great. I hate doing these things, I'm sorry, but listen, I hope to see you all again at some point. Maybe you'll come back and do the summer school or do a longer course with us at Queen's. At the Heaney Centre. Now keep writing and keep reading, and I hope to read your poems every time I open a poetry journal. Okay, hope you're all keeping well during this shitstorm. Take care. Thanks, bye.
The Seamus Heaney Poetry Summer School is an annual intensive week of study for emerging poets, hosted by the Seamus Heaney Centre at Queen's and led by Professor Nick Laird. The Seamus Heaney Centre podcast is created in a small back room by Ian Sansom, Stephen Sexton and Rachel Brown. This episode was produced by Connor McCafferty. Thanks, as always, to our writers and to Nick Boyle for his music.